step, capacitors in the right locations to create whatever impedance you want of your triaxial cable, the outer impedance. You could have a whole lot of fun with this one, Steve, if you wanted to. Possibly you're going to run that experiment, and when you do, you're going to let us know what you find. KD2HUC, blazing a brand new trail, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting one, Dick, because, you know, like I said, it is a fan dipole. It's 80 through 10 meters. So not only am I going to have to find the magic length of cable, but I got to calculate the magic length of cable for all bands. Because what might be perfect on 80 might not be so good on 10. So although they sure work out to be rough fractions, it's something we're going to have to look at. The antenna, I don't know if the balun, if it includes a balun. I probably should just email Alpha Delta, because looking online, I couldn't get a definitive answer whether or not the center insulator actually contains a one-to-one balun. I did purchase an external balun, and, you know, but like I said, that will have to be located elsewhere. The other question I have is, you talked about putting a capacitor between the outer shield of the conductor going up to the antenna and the mast. Would that be effective? I mean, the mast certainly would have to be grounded for lightning protection, and I would think that the ground is going to run through for the shield of the cable, even through the balun. So, how would that affect, you know, trying to tune it with a capacitor between the shield and the mast? KD2, HUC, back to you.
Let me hear a couple more words on the mast. Is the mast going to be a chimney mount on the chimney of your house, or is the mast going to be mounted at the top of your tower? What's holding up that mast? Give me a few words on that one, Steve. Go ahead.
Pick up Rich, UPS. Here's a comment.
Well, Dick, it's sort of my own view of a tower. Around my neighborhood, you use the word tower, and next thing you know, neighbors are showing up with pitchforks. So I like to use the word mast. The mast is extending up from a concrete footing. It's attaching to a structure in my backyard, my shed, and extending up about 30 feet or so. And that is where I'm relocating my antennas. So, the cable is going to be coming down through the inside of this. And as you can, see my issue, I have to watch the length if the balun is at the bottom, because that's where, it would make the most sense for me to install it. But that's why I'm posing the question. Now, you're going to try and tune the cable with a capacitor between this mast, which, like I said, would have to be grounded for lightning protection, and the outside of the cable, which is, as far as I can tell, unless I put some sort of an insulated connector that serves as a gap on the shield, is also connected to ground. How is that going to, how are they going to play together, is my question.
Okay, I fully understand why you're not calling this structure a tower, why you're calling it a mast. To go one step more complete, you could call it an antenna support structure, ASS, antenna support structure, or antenna support mechanism, and that's what it's really doing. On top of that, although people in many communities are scared to death of towers, this is a very irrational fear. We all have seen a fair number of pictures of ham radio towers that have failed, and after they failed, they laid over the top of somebody's house, and you have never, never seen a photograph of a ham radio tower that did any substantial amount of penetration of a private dwelling, for a very good reason. As I was chainsawing all of those oak trees in my backyard after Hurricane Sandy, I suddenly realized, boy, these things are heavy. So I took a chunk of oak tree and weighed it, measured its dimensions and weighed it, and found out that they run around 55 pounds per cubic foot, my particular oak trees. And so my particular oak trees, in general, are 10 times heavier per foot compared to Rhone 55 tower. Very few hams put up heavier ham radio tower than Rhone 55. Mine happens to be a Rhone 55. And so the tree is 10 times heavier in pounds per foot and quite a bit stiffer than my tower. As such, a tree in somebody's backyard is a hell of a lot more dangerous as far as penetrating a house compared to a radio tower. So for people to have this irrational fear about the shiny new radio tower being a threat to their life in the home and property is craziness. Let me drop. Now, in your particular case, where you've got this mast and you're going to run the coax cable up the center of it, quite possibly, I think the most desirable thing to do would be to ground the coax cable right at the bottom of your mast. Where it enters the mast is where it's going to be grounded. So you could, with some kind of a fancy mechanical structure, literally install a coax connector at the bottom of your mast, and the transmission line gets picked up on the inside from that coax connector. Is one way of doing it. How you'd reach inside to fasten the connector, I'm not quite sure. So grounding the cable right at the base is a desirable way to do it. And then the rest of the cable going to the shack, you wouldn't have to worry about it. And now, if you wanted to tune your triaxial system, you would be putting a capacitor between the coax cable and the mast at the top of the mast. And now you'd be tuning that triaxial length as an RF choke if you wanted to. The simpler approach is a real balloning device, poor man's ballon or a real ballon. But you have the option of using your triaxial coax cable going up your mast as a tuned structure, and even if it turns out to be the wrong length, by putting the right value of capacitor between the shield and the mast at the top of the mast, you can now tune that length at least at one frequency at a time. You see what's going on here, Steve. You can have a lot of fun with this one. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is why I posed this one to the TechNet, because I was hoping to get some insight, and I certainly have. I certainly agree with you on the irrational fear of towers. I've done a lot of searching on the internet, and all the pictures that I have seen are tower failures. I've never seen a tower, you know, fall over like a stick, so to speak. You know, they're usually crumpling on themselves and whatnot. But just to play it safe, the height of this thing gives me 25 feet of leeway from any other structures other than my shed, which is really, you know, not real worried about. So even if this thing did happen to fall like a stick, it would have to blow 25 feet, 30 feet off of the base and then fall like a stick in order to hit somebody's house. And even then, so, like you pointed out, I doubt it would do any significant damage. My antenna might not fare up so well, but the structure should be safe. So, I'm actually forging ahead with this, and I will certainly be able to record my findings. So, I'll let you know. Rich had some comments. UPS, KD2, HUC.
You got it, Rich. K2UPS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, good evening. K2UPS Mobile, West Virginia now. My comment is a good solution to keep the RF off the shield coming down on coax would be to use ferrite beads. You know, you've got a dozen or so taped on, slip the coax through before you attach it to the center insulator of that dipole. And tape it up into a little bundle. Of course, it's going to depend on what the inside diameter of his mast is. But even if they're too fat to fit, he may be able to put like a short support extension at the top just to help hold that up. But that would work quite nicely for keeping the RF off of the shield. That's it, Dick. Back to net.
When you have a very small diameter ferrite device and you're about to slip it over the wire of a RCA 07 resistor, for instance. People call that a ferrite bead. When you make the bead big enough that it can fit over a coax cable, most people will call it a ferrite toroid. But you, without a doubt, you're absolutely right, Rich. You slip a number of ferrite toroids or any kind of magnetic toroids over the outside of your coax cable. You're now creating an RF choke. And if you took apart a unidelta ballon, that's exactly what's inside. A whole bunch of magnetic toroids slipped over the outside of the coax. That's exactly what's inside. So And we've already explained once before in one of the techniques about the fact that any current flowing on your conductor, outer conductor of your conductor, flowing along it, uses the right-hand rule. Your thumb is the direction of the current. Your fingers wrapping around the wire is where the magnetic field wants to go as rings around the wire. And if you put a magnetic toroid in that area, and the magnetic toroid has a permeability of 100 or 1,000, permeability means the magnetic field flows through that material 100 or 1,000 times better than it does through air. So putting that toroid around your conductor gives it a 100 or 1,000 times better place where the magnetic field will flow. And that's a fancy way of saying your conductor that used to have 22 nanohenries per inch may now go to 22 microhenries per inch. You've increased the inductance per length by 1,000-fold in some cases. And therefore, it becomes an RF choke. It's a little bit funny as to how it happens, but that's how it happens. Okay. So whether or not the company that manufactured your fan dipole, let me drop it. Whether or not that company included the ball in there, whether or not they completely ignored it and forgot it, quite possibly they did, or whether or not they're suggesting you air the ball, those are all minor details. Those are all minor details as I see it, Steve, and I wouldn't worry about it. Any dipole will operate without a ball. It's just more desirable to have it with a ball. Let's do another call for Mr. QEQ. Len, is he there? WB2QEQ, who signed in earlier. K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Len. Maybe Len is not there. So it's time to go over to the mailbag. KC2WGB, that very provocative question you got about the weight or gravity of electricity or of electrons last week, that's still an ongoing discussion. You and I have had emails from Roy. We've had a significant discussion with Glenn. And not only did we dwell on it for more than an hour last Sunday night, but we dwelled on it, you and I and a lot of other people dwelled on it for another hour or so on Monday night. And more emails have flown back and forth. Provocative question. Not simple to answer, getting down to the atomic level, but that's where all this action takes place. So quite possibly the submitter of that question last week is due a prize, John. And do you have any more of those really wild questions tonight? KC2WGB in the mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, not quite so esoteric, but yeah, that was fun. Love those questions. And all of you guys out there, keep sending them in, guys and gals. All right, let me let her drop and I'll go on to the first one.
B2K, them with a comment.
Who's that person with a comment?
Rich WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike with a comment to Steve.
Okay, with Steve's fan dipole, go right ahead, Golf X-Ray November, I think it is, K2RIW.
And the appropriate
Mr. Golf X-Ray November, we may have to ask you to repeat your message a little bit later. We're going to go over to the mailbag right now, and I thank you for that offer. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Are you copying me okay?
Loud and clear. Go right ahead.
Okay, very good. And I'll say hello to everybody on the net, Dick, Paul, and all of you interested people. All right, this young gentleman is replacing a 60-cycle diode. It's a simple 1-amp diode, and it's rated at 600 volts. Now, it has a PID rating of 1.2 kilovolts. His old one is 1,000 PID. He wants to know if you can explain to him what is that rating and does it make a difference in his application. And it said 60 cycles. I think I mentioned that. Back to you, Dick.
It sounds like he is using it in a 60-cycle circuit. PID stands for peak inverse voltage. Every diode has at least two ratings, three ratings. Number one, what's the maximum forward current you can put through it before you overheat it? Number two, what's the maximum reverse voltage you can put on it before you arc it over, so to speak, and starts acting like a Zener diode? And any diode in power rectification circuit which is acting like a Zener diode, it starts burning up power real fast. In this particular case of, let's say, a 1,000 or 1,200 volt diode, if the peak inverse voltage rating was 1,200 volts, and you put 1,300 volts on it, and it starts drawing current, and let's assume that it draws a rather minor amount of current at first, 10 milliamps. 10 milliamps of current flowing at 1,200 or 1,300 volts is 12 or 13 watts of dissipation inside of that little diode. Obviously, you're going to burn it up real fast. So you want to make sure you don't exceed peak inverse voltage rating. Now, the peak inverse voltage rating of a power supply rectifying diode is a little bit mysterious. Let me show you why. Let's assume now that I'm building a power supply that I want to provide 100 volts output. And I've got a transformer that I'm going to be feeding it. And assume now I've got four diodes set up as a full-wave rectifier. And I'm going to feed that with a transformer. Common sense would lead you to believe that I make sure the secondary winding of the transformer supplies 100 volts, like it's full-wave rectified, and now I've got 100 volts of DC. Good common sense, not the way it works. The 100-volt rating of your AC voltmeter is an RMS rating, root mean squared. That's a mathematical function, which means heating characteristic.
Repeater, timeout.
You know that voltage coming out of the wall has got a 60-cycle sine wave voltage to it. Therefore, as that 60-cycle sine wave goes into your light bulb or into a resistor, it may have an amount of voltage that gives you the same amount of heating as 100 volts of DC. And you would think 100-volt peak voltage of AC would do the same. Well, it only hits peak for a very brief period of time, and for the rest of the time, it's putting out a smaller voltage, giving you less heating. The bottom line of all that is the real peak voltage is square root of 2 times what you call our voltage rating. 100-volt sine wave coming out of a transformer, 100-volt RMS reading on an AC voltmeter that's accurate, really hits 167-volt peak. I think it's the right number. Square root of 2, 1.71, might be 171. It's either 167, 171. So the peak voltage is quite a bit higher than the so-called RMS voltage. And you've got to design that into your power supply in order to make the voltage come out right. On top of that, let's assume now that you are building a 100-volt power supply, in my example, and maybe the right voltage that you're going to have coming out of the secondary winding of the transformer to do that is 71 volts. So you've got 71 volts AC on your meter as the voltage coming out of the secondary winding. But that voltage does hit a peak of 100 volts, and if your rectifier was an ideal rectifier going into an ideal capacitor, that peak voltage would be seen by your rectifier in that capacitor, and the capacitor would be charged to 100 volts. Let me drop. So You've got the 70-volt rating of a transformer, really making 100 volts peak. Therefore, your rectifier plus capacitor of this power supply gets charged to 100 volts. On the next half cycle, when the voltage goes negative and the diode is not conducting, this is a halfway rectified simple power supply, your voltage is now going to go minus 100 volts peak on the voltage coming out of the transformer, while the capacitor voltage on the other end of the diode is sitting at plus 100 volts. Therefore, the diode on that 100 volt power supply of my example will see 200 volts peak inverse rating. So, rough rule of thumb, whatever voltage you want to come out of a power supply with, the diode better have a peak inverse rating more than twice the voltage you desire, just to be on the safe side, probably 2.5 times. And you don't want to exceed, you don't want the actual voltage you apply, you don't want that voltage to ever exceed peak inverse rating. The next thing you got to worry about is what's the inrush current going to be. If it's one of these very simple power supplies, which runs directly off the 110-volt line, rectifies the 110-volt line, that in turn goes into an inverter circuit that steps it up with an inverter and plus transformer to some higher or lower voltage. Well, when you first flip that on-off switch, and that current coming from Con Ed, so to speak, has an internal resistance of milliohms, and that's going to go through your diode, and it's going to try to charge your 1,000 microfarad capacitor. One of the rules of electronics is that you cannot change the voltage instantaneously on a capacitor. So if you happen to flip that on-off switch at the instant of time that Con Ed is sitting at peak voltage, 167 volts, that's your 120 volts, by the way, AC, is something like 167 volts is the peak voltage coming out of Con Ed. So 167 volts backed up by only a milliohm of resistance means you've got thousands of amperes of inrush current on that example that I just gave. And so the one cycle peak current that your diode can tolerate for your particular power supply is something you've also got to worry about. To be on the safe side, some people will put a 1-ohm resistor in series with the diode to limit that peak inrush current. At first, you would think a 1-ohm resistor is not going to do anything. Well, if you actually did a careful calculation of the impedance of that wire going back to your fuse panel on your 200-ampere service of your house, you might calculate that it's got a milliohm of resistance. And by adding a 1-ohm or a 10-ohm resistor, you're making the inrush current go 1,000 times or lower or 10,000 times lower, because as the ratio of the real impedance of that circuit, meaning back to your fuse panel and back to the pole big transformer out in front of your house versus the real resistance you've added to your circuit. So these power supplies, everybody think it's so simple. When you get down to the nitty-gritty of making a high reliability power supply, there's quite a few other factors you got to think about. This is some of the information I think he needs, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet. Why don't you add a few more words of your experience with diodes, inrush current, peak inverse voltage, putting diodes in series, putting diodes in parallel, and so on. You've got it, John. K2RAW.
Yes, Dick, I agree with your statement, KC2WGB. The fact that he's going to replace it with a higher rated PIV, I think he's fine. He can do that without worrying about it. His original was 1,000 PIV, and this one's 1.2, and that's what he was wondering, if that really made a difference. But that'll be a benefit for him, so I think he should just go ahead and replace the diode and carry on with whatever he's doing. Yep. Diodes, and the other thing you must remember, or people must remember when they're replacing diode, is the slew rate, or the switching speed of the diode. When you get into high frequency, you take a 60-cycle diode and you put it at 15, 20 kilohertz, that diode is not going to last. That's another thing. The frequency that the diode operates at is another thing of concern. 60-cycle, you can use just about anything. But very good. I think that helped him out. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, that's another good point I should have mentioned. And that that is if the diode that you're adding is the output transformer rectifier of a switching regulator or of a an inverter, and some inverter designs run at 10 kilohertz, 100 kilohertz, and so therefore it's got to be a diode rating for that frequency region, quite possibly a Schottky diode. Those are the fast diodes, the Schottkys. And so if it's anything but a 60-cycle or a 400-cycle circuit you're putting the diode into, then worry about the frequency rating of your diode. A 60-cycle power, inexpensive diode, on the forward current, stores energy into its diode region, its PN junction. And so it takes a certain length of time to drain that stored energy, those majority carriers, back out of there. In the case of a 60-cycle waveform, which is something like 16.6 milliseconds for each cycle, it's got a whole lot of time to slowly drain those current out, those charge carriers out of the diode during the next half of the cycle when it's not conducting. At very high frequencies, you can get a substantial amount of reverse current flowing in the diode on the back side of the rectification, on the other half of the sine wave. And so there's a specially made kind of diode that uses that characteristic. Let me go up. There's something called a... all of a sudden I forgot the name of these fancy diodes that T-converse, what's the name of the diode that intentionally generates high frequency circuits? It'll come to me a little bit later.
You thinking of pin diode?
Good guess, not a pin diode. There is a kind of diode which is intentionally designed so that when the other half of the sine wave hits the diode, when it's no longer rectifying, the charge carriers inside the diode are being drained away, it's drawing current, and when they get drained away, I think it's called a snap action diode, among other names, the current flowing in the reverse direction of the diode abruptly stops, and it abruptly stops in numbers like picoseconds. Therefore, these frequency multiplying diodes that use this effect can easily multiply your input frequency by 10 or 100 times using this inverse charge abrupt change effect. As I said, I'll eventually think of the name of these fancy diodes.
Good. Step recovery?
That's the word I'm looking for, step recovery diode. Thank you. So the step recovery diode is intentionally designed to do this crazy thing, which is on the forward cycle of conduction, you're storing energy in the diode. On the reverse half cycle of the input sine wave, it's drawing current, a substantial amount of current, but in the middle of that peak inverse voltage, the current abruptly changes in picoseconds of the step recovery diode. And whenever you calculate the Fourier series of crazy waveforms, in other words, the rise time and the fall time of your waveform represents much, much higher frequencies if that rise time and fall time is brief enough. So very sharp edges of, say, a square wave or the step recovery diode waveform is extremely rich in higher frequency components. And so for frequency multiplier assemblies, that's an extremely handy effect. So that very simple looking thing called diode, properly used, can be multiplying frequency. In the case of a parametric amplifier diode, it can be giving you amplification. In the case of a Varecta diode, it can give you voltage tunable capacitance. There's a lot more to a diode that first meets the eye. Over to you, John, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
I think it's called high speed recovery, not step high speed recovery.
Step recovery diodes. Yeah, there are diodes, Glenn, that are intentionally designed for the step recovery effect, and as a frequency multiplying assembly on brick oscillator assemblies. Boy, are those handy. A very popular brick oscillator assembly that's used by the microwave guys. There's a cavity tuned oscillator running at roughly 1500 megacycles, and then that feeds a step recovery diode, which feeds a filter assembly, and out comes 10.224 gigahertz, all being multiplied by that step recovery diode and filtered by the filter network. And so out comes plus 17 dBm when you fed in a fraction of a watt at 1.7 gigahertz. Very handy structure. I bet you've seen some of those brick oscillator assemblies that blend KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, but this was a power supply question, wasn't that? So in other words, like a for a switching power supply, switching even at, you know, a couple, you know, 100 kilohertz or so, you know, a high-speed recovery diode with like a 35 nanosecond recovery time is, a, you know, it's a power part that you probably want to use in that circuit. That's what I was thinking, Vic. K4IW, K2QIQ, and that wouldn't be a step recovery. That's just high-speed recovery.
And you're absolutely right, Glenn. And the point I was a little bit off to one side is to say that there are many kinds of diodes in many kinds of applications. So step recovery frequency multiplication is what I was just discussing. Varactive diodes for electronic tuning. Glenn is now talking about the recovery time of diodes being used for the rectifying circuit of a high-speed inverter. And why in the world would somebody build a high-speed inverter? By making the transistors in your inverter, your AC oscillator, power oscillator assembly, operate at a high frequency, means that the amount of iron in that transformer now becomes very small. The number of microfarads required for the filtering becomes a hell of a lot smaller. So you pick up a whole lot of advantages once you build that inverter circuit into your power supply. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. Also, anybody who's ever made the mistake of putting a 60-cycle diode in place of a fast recovery will notice, like you say, Dick, your fingers are very well and very well adapted for heat. In a couple of seconds, you will know you've got the wrong diode in there, for sure. But this is a regular 60-cycle power supply. It's not a switching supply. So it was just a question of the PIV. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to our next scientist. This is a good one. Okay, Dick, I hope we got some help in the net tonight. This young gentleman wants to know, why do ships use low frequency for foghorns when he knows the klaxons and the steam whistles are a lot louder? Why do they use that extremely low frequency foghorn? Maybe you know, Dick. I never asked that question on ships.
Somewhat similar to why elephants communicate with each other with extremely low frequencies. When you study the insertion loss of air versus frequency over very long distances, those very low frequency notes in air propagate with a hell of a lot less loss than high frequency notes. You'll also notice, for instance, that, take my word for it, a lightning bolt really makes a lot of very high frequency sound, and yet it's a low rumble you hear when that lightning bolt is far away from you. If that lightning bolt happens to strike your tower in your backyard real close to you, you'll suddenly notice that it has an extremely different sound. Not only is it a hell of a lot louder, but you hear high frequency components. So there's something magic about air, that the high frequency components get attenuated a lot faster than the low frequency notes. They carry a lot further, therefore you can hear that foghorn even though you're like a significant number of miles away from the shore, and that foghorn is telling you that your ship is about to run into a lot of fog. This foghorn is in a particular direction with your hearing. Let me drop. You can know what direction that sound is coming from, and because you know that foghorn is telling you there's going to be a lot of fog, you know that if there is a rocky shore near that coast of that particular country that you're about to approach, you better be very careful with your navigation. You don't really want your ship to run aground because you're going to make a whole lot of people unhappy. That's some of what I think is going on. You've done a lot more nautical work than I have, John, so tell us what you've been told. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I was told, basically, that the excessive vibration it causes things to rattle and shake, windows to vibrate. As you know, if you live near the coastline, you can hear those horns for miles. I know when I was on board ship, you could feel it in the cavity of your chest. It was very strong, very powerful. So I assume you're right, and with the high-density moisture levels and fog, maybe that's a benefit also. But I never really asked the question directly, but sounds good.
Comment. Yeah, I was recently involved with a project, very remotely involved. I was alongside of people that were doing the work, where they were doing ultrasonic transmissions at 20 kilohertz, 50 kilohertz, and 100 kilohertz, numbers like that. And they just wanted to transmit a low-level signal for intelligence reasons, that wanted to transmit data across the numbers like 100 feet inside of a laboratory. And they did experience significantly more dB per foot of loss at, say, 50 kilohertz and 100 kilohertz as opposed to 20 kilohertz. So there's a magic quality of air which has more insertion loss at higher frequencies. AP West has run into that. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, West.
N2XJN. Well, the typical range, the person could hear is from 20 to 20,000. So, if we look at that sound wave like a longitudinal wave, which is the mechanical wave, then we see the properties of it that differ in some way to the transfer wave. Now, the longitudinal wave has a vector of direction as well. So when we're talking about the sound, we're talking about the pressure factor that's assigned to a trading job. For the low frequency sounds, it acts as a barrier. So let's say you have a cloud, or you have a just different pressure at a given point, say 20 feet, 100 feet, and that could be due to the existence of existing buildings or whatsoever. Now, that bounce in the direction usually with the angle of incidence, and that's why the lower frequencies are being used for the horns, because in the ocean, the one certain pattern that acts as a barrier is the surface of the ocean. The other one is the butt of the ship. Now, some of the sound that actually bounce back from the wave is bounce from the wall of the ship. Now it's being reflected perpendicular parallel to the surface of the sea, of the ocean. Now it goes very far away. And also, the human ear is more sensitive into the lower frequencies. If you look at the subwoofer, sometimes the car passing by, you don't see high sounds at all. You just see the vibration of your even building that you're sitting with, and then you see how come, how many watts this guy has in the car, what is happening, and to his ear.
There's a lot of things going on here. When you look at the so-called Fletcher-Munson curves of the acoustic response of the human hearing system, your hearing has a peak in sensitivity somewhere like 600 hertz, 1,000 hertz, in that order, is where your hearing has a lot of sensitivity. Your hearing supposedly works, if you're a young person, 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. But you measure the sensitivity of a human hearing system at 20 hertz. It is, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's 40 dB less sensitive at 10 hertz or 20 hertz than it is at, say, 1 kilohertz. Now, whenever you've got a reflecting medium, like the dirt in your backyard reflecting your radio waves versus the eyesight, your eye operates at a very high frequency, a very small wavelength, therefore your eye can see minor bumps and grinds in the lawn and the soil in your backyard, and so you really see the elevation effects, the terrain effects, if you know what I mean. Whereas The radio wave at 20 meters looks at your backyard as almost a perfect mirror. Let me drop. The wavelength of audio you can calculate by a very rough approximation. Sound travels through air at something like 1,100 feet per second. Let me round it off the number to 1,000 feet per second. And if I'm transmitting a 20 hertz signal through that air, 20 divided into 1,000 is roughly 50. So in other words, the wavelength of a 20 hertz audio wave in air is around 50 feet. And so now, how smooth is that sea state compared to a 50-foot wave? You're going to now get a nice specular reflection off of that sea, unless it's got great big ocean waves, if you know what I mean. The higher frequency sound is now going to be a lot more scattered by the individual shape of that wave of the ocean. So the signal that bounces off the ocean itself is sort of what Wes was telling us. You're not going to get as clean a reflection at those higher frequencies. So you put it all together. I think those fog long frequencies are chosen to be heard as a distinctive signal giving you warning. Let me drop. So you want it to be a distinctive signal that you can easily recognize that's giving you warning. The way your hearing system works, the direction finding of your hearing works very well at those frequencies. So by swishing your head back and forth, you easily can detect what direction the sound is coming from. And because it's a frequency that's chosen to be very long in range, now a good number of miles away you can hear it. So you know it's giving you a warning because of its characteristic sound. It's giving you a direction because you can easily direction find it with your hearing of your system. And you're hearing it from a long distance away, and therefore it's doing its major job, warning you that you're about to run into a rocky shore in the fog of this particular sea coast of this particular nation. And around the perimeter of a lot of nations, United States included, boy, there's a zillion ships underwater that were sunk in previous years because they ran into the rocks on a foggy night. And you really want to avoid that. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the deck net.
KC2WGB. Good question. A lot of fun there. Yeah, running into rocks is not good. And you're right, it sure has happened a lot. Well, while we're on the spectrum of sound, I have a young man here who has a question on the Doppler effect. Let me let it drop. Okay, we have two people. One is transmitting a frequency of, let's say, 1,000 cycles. We have the other gentleman a distance away receiving that frequency. Now, his question is, if from the transmitter we have a breeze or a wind blowing at 100 miles an hour, do we have a Doppler effect on the sound? Maybe you can handle that one for him, Dick. Over to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, that's a beauty. And the reason why it's such a beauty is because the way Doppler works, it's a little bit different if the emitter is moving versus the receiver moving. If a train is moving toward you, and it's tooting its horn, ringing its bell, or whatever, without a doubt, you're going to hear a higher frequency. And if the train is moving toward you at the speed of sound, 746 miles an hour, roughly, at sea level, trains don't go that fast. But maybe it's a rocket sled, Mr. Stapp's rocket sled, where he was doing these experiments in the late 40s and early 50s. You wouldn't hear the sound at all until the rocket sled gets to you, and then you're going to hear a very loud hear all of those cycles all at once that he's emitting, if you know what I mean. So if he's moving toward you at the speed of sound, you don't hear him until the sound gets to you. A sound. If he is sitting still and emitting a sound, and you're moving toward him, you're going to hear the sound continuously at a very calculatable, much higher frequency. If you move toward him at the speed of sound, I think the frequency you hear is exact twice as high. I have to work out the mathematics of that. But I think the frequency will be twice as high if the guy doing the receiving is moving at the speed of sound. But if the emitter is moving at the speed of sound, you hear nothing until he gets to you. So, as you can see, transmitting and receiving and speed of the air around is quite different. Now, if the air is moving 100 miles an hour directly between the two guys, the guy that's making the note and the guy that's receiving, at one end, you've got what looks like...
Repeater, timeout.
At the transmitting end, you've got the equivalent of the emitter moving away from the guy that's receiving. Let's assume now that the guy on the north side of this experiment is operating a 1 kilohertz signal generator. He's putting out an audio signal. And there's a guy south of him some distance away hearing the signal. And if the wind's not blowing, the guy to the south hears exactly 1 KC note. But now let's assume that the wind is blowing from north to south at, let's say, 100 miles an hour, which is possible. 1/10 the speed of sound, so to speak. Therefore, the sound waves going into that air near the guy at the north, when the sound waves get to the guy at the south, they're being squeezed back together, but the rate of stretch and the rate of squeeze is not the same. Very similar to what happened when that car is moving toward you at the speed of sound. You hear nothing until he gets to you, if he's moving, but if you're moving toward him and he's stationary, you hear twice the note. So you're going to be getting some of that effect. So if the wind is blowing from the side, you're now getting a triangular effect. As you can tell, I'm not giving a great answer. I haven't heard this one yet. I haven't studied this one. But because of the difference in the Doppler for the transmitter speed versus the difference in Doppler for the receiving speed, this is not a simple problem. Over to you, Joe. Here we go. John, KC2WGB, K2LAW. He hasn't got an answer yet, but it ain't simple.
KC2WGB. Well, look at it as compression waves. The compression waves are being emitted into the 100-mile air with the same spacing, are they not? So, why should it change?
Okay. Let's figure out the way sound works, John. What's really crazy is the air that's in the room with you right now. Those air molecules are moving on average 500 meters per second. That is their speed. I didn't say velocity, I said speed. And the reason I'm using that word is because velocity means they've got a clearly defined direction and some particular rate of movement. Well, those air molecules are bouncing all over the place. But their average speed, 500 meters per second, 1.5 times the speed of sound. So when your loudspeaker puts out a sound, some of those nearby air molecules, say your loudspeaker is aimed to the north, some of those nearby air molecules on the compression wave out of your loudspeaker are moving faster than normal, faster than 500 meters per second as they proceed to the north. And the other half cycle of what's going on with your loudspeaker, they're moving slower. And so, on average, these molecules of air are moving 500 meters per second, conveying that new information. Okay. So now, at first you would think that air moving at 500 meters per second, at 100 miles an hour, in our example, a guy is north of the guy on the north side is operating some kind of an audio transmitter, and the guy on the south side of this experiment is listening, and the air is blowing 100 miles an hour from north to south. Would the guy on the south hear the exact same frequency as the guy on the north? You're giving an example of where you think the answer is there's no shift in frequency. Well, is that true? You might be right. I'm going to think about this one some more. And
additional comment.
Go ahead, John.
Well, let's look at it this way. We're in a river basin. The river is flowing south. Now, that's the same as air. It travels a lot faster in water. But now, if we made that tone at the head and it travels toward the south, you're going to tell me it would be traveling faster in the water or slower? I think it would be exactly the same, would it not?
It's given a good strong example there, John. So that guy is making waves in the water. Let's assume that he's making some kind of a, he's operating some kind of a plunger in the water, and he's making minor waves at the one wave every foot. And who cares how fast the river is flowing? Is flowing. The guy to the south is still going to count one wave every foot, so to speak. I think you're right. But I'm going to think about it some more. In the case of air, see, a wave traveling on the surface of water and the compression longitudinal wave traveling through air is a little bit different. If that air was traveling at very high velocities compared to the speed of sound, you know, 10% or 50% of the speed of sound, be the exact same frequency.
What if we rang the chime underwater and not use the surface? Would it travel at a different rate with the current?
At first, it looks like you're right and you're winning the argument, John. It looks like there should be no difference. If I had to vote under duress, I would say there should be no difference. I'm a little bit worried in the case of high-speed air, would there be a slight difference? And I'm going to think about it some more. For the time being, let's vote that there's no difference. But I'm holding out a little bit of reservation. There could be a difference, I think. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. No, I think we should hold it in abeyance and do a little more thinking. I'm going to do the same thing. That is a very interesting question, and I'm really not sure. That's just a question of how you look at it. But, all right, I think we should go on to Paul. That's it from the mailbag. Great night tonight. Good stuff. Back to you, Dick.
So, are you saying you've run out of questions for the mailbag tonight, John? Over to you.
Yep, that completes my questions.
Okay, it's time for
comment, KC2OJO.
Mr. OJO, start it to a name, sir. Give us your prefix, and then give us your comment. Go right ahead, Mr. OJO.
KC2OJO, Howard.
Go right ahead with your comment, Howard.
Right now, if you look on the internet, you would find that people are selling anemometers that work in air, that work by exactly what we're talking about, sending tones from one microphone, receiving it at another. They're both transceivers, generally, and they work. The wind, as it flows between the two, definitely does affect the frequency.
Wow. Howard, what's the brand name of the anemometer you're talking about? And if I understand correctly, it's got a transmitter, tiny loudspeaker. It's probably operating an ultrasonic frequency to maximize the effect. It's got a detecting receiver, a microphone-like device. And in other words, as the air changes speed, velocity, the tone changes, and you're telling me that this instrument looks at the change in tone, and it says, aha, that wind is moving 10 miles an hour. I think that's approximately what you're telling me, Howard. Darn, interesting. What's the brand name of the anemometer that works by that technique? KC2OJO, K2LIW. Thank you, Howard.
Years ago, I was interested in this, so I looked at a couple of the patents. I can't recall any brand name off the cuff. I'm sure you will find them. However, they work by two ways. By sending an impulse from one, which goes to the other, and it can be timed. The impulses, usually you need at least three or four, because remember, it's a vector, and you have to be able to be sampling the wind in different directions. But they can work on tone, or they can work on impulse timing.
I'm beginning to see it, Howard. Beautiful. Picture this one, John. You've got a guy that's transmitting a pulse from the north. You've got a guy that's receiving the pulse to the south. And the two of them are tied together with some kind of an exact timing device. If the air is moving real fast from north to south, that pulse that the guy put into the air from the north is going to arrive at the south quicker than normal. So at least the timing changes, therefore the phase of the signal changes. Whether or not a continuous tone would be sensed as a different frequency is not yet clear, but I can see how the timing is going to change. Are you starting to see that picture, John? There's more to this than meets the eye. What else is new? KC2WGB, K2IW and the Tech Man.
Does molecules take up space? No, I know what he's talking about. I don't know if that's applicable to what the question was from this young gentleman. But, yeah, I know they have pulse timing that is distributing the information about the rotational speed of that propeller. So, as the wind increases, the pulses get closer together. You know, that is understandable. But I have to think about it. That's why I said we'll hold it in advance.
Now, if I wanted to have high accuracy wind speed indication, and therefore I know I'm running a loudspeaker at, say, 1 kilohertz, and I've got a receiver, let me pick a number, a couple of feet away, listening to 1 kilohertz, and I've got a synchronous demodulator, or let's call it a very narrow band receiver, looking for nothing but 1 kilohertz. But the timing between the two, you admit that the pulse coming out of the northern loudspeaker is going to get to the southern loudspeaker faster if the wind is blowing from the north to the south. That's if you're sending a pulse. If I'm transmitting a continuous tone, the leading edge of that tone is going to get there earlier. Therefore, if I'm measuring the phase angle of the 1 kilohertz note being transmitted from the north to the south, that phase angle of that continuous tone will be advanced if the wind is moving from north to south. So even with continuous tone, by measuring phase shift of the audio that's received, I can interpret that into wind speed. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yes, but don't forget that compression, don't look at the leading edge of the wave, look at the entire wave. The frequency is not going to change due to airspeed, whether it arrives sooner or later. The distance between the peaks of the pulses are going to stay the same, I believe.
I agree with that, John. I use the pulse as an example of the phenomena. The pulse will arrive sooner if the wind is blowing from north to south, in our example. Now I'm listening to a continuous tone, and there's a huge advantage of listening to a continuous tone, because I now can integrate a whole lot of data. I'm getting 1,000 cycles every second, and I'm integrating every one of those cycles. And as I integrate those cycles, and with my timing circuit, I'm carefully measuring the phase angle of the 1 kilohertz tone that I received to the south. By measuring that phase angle, I can get a very accurate, very small amount of timing change sensitivity. You give me a high enough tone, and you allow me to measure the tone phase angle continuously, I can now give you a very accurate wind speed indicator, I believe. Yes, the guy to the south is going to still hear, in our example, a 1 KC tone. But if he's got the right kind of circuitry, he's going to see that phase shift with high accuracy and high signal-to-noise ratio, because he's integrating, listening to nothing but 1 kilohertz tones and rejecting everything else and measuring the phase angle of that tone. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, then there will be no difference in Doppler.
Oh? Then tell me why the phase angle shifted.
But it's a continuous tone. That phase angle will be steady, from my point of view, and I don't think that would lead to a Doppler shift.
Can't you have a Doppler shift in phase instead of a Doppler shift in frequency? Open you, John.
Yes, but it would have to be a continuous shift to hear a difference that amounts to frequency. I think the tone quality would be the same, in my estimation. But
it's not as easy as we think. Some of these simple questions are really cranky.
If this was an experiment in which we're measuring the wavelength of light being emitted, and if the emitter was moving at close to the speed of light and or the detector